to join us. If you think there's room, I can sit there. Otherwise, I'm comfortable here. I'll just stay here. I think you guys are around us. That's right.
All right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started today. We have a smaller crowd. A bunch of people reached out today, but they wouldn't be able to make it for a variety of reasons. So we're going to go get started and introduce who is here. Ann, do you want to start?
Ann Gallivan, Daisy Wells Brothers.
Becky Coobin, City of Virginia Beach.
Russ Perkinson, riparian landowner.
Mark Lukenbach, Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
Michael Killeen, Shellfish Growers of Virginia.
Beverly Ledford, Fletcher House Oysters.
Andrew Button, VMRC.
Ellen Boland, VMRC.
Ben Stagg, VMRC.
Tony Watkinson, Marine Resources Commission.
And Hank is somewhere. I think he's going to be joining us in a minute. Wanted to thank you guys, as always, for your time and for coming today. I don't think we're going to go the full 2 hours today. We have a smaller crowd, and we have a few less items on the agenda. And we are still doing some work internally to figure out the best way to approach the guidelines around lease renewal criteria, and also working with the secretary to make sure we are fully implementing the law sort of according to that, according to his thoughts, and making sure we are in line with that. So taking it a little bit longer than we had planned. So today, what we're going to do is, at the previous meeting, you all had requested that Ben sort of present a couple of renewals in terms of how he approached them and when he didn't initially get information and how he went back. But I think there was some concerns about, you know, what if this person didn't meet the numerical threshold of a bushel of effort per acre per year. So Ben's going to present that case, and then we're going to have a conversation about thoughts around use plans and what criteria we should use when we are assigning lease ground. So we started at the end in terms of determining what we should do for renewals, because it made sense to have that conversation. We were also talking about renewal fees, and now we're going back to the beginning of how do we get it right from the beginning to make sure that we are leasing ground to people who will be able to use it to its highest and best use and implement the law. Any other thoughts or comments or questions before we start?
Well, I just want to wish Tommy good luck in Bermuda.
Yeah. So noted.
If he does head that way. And do you know if he has?
I don't. I, you're right. I forget that's where he was headed. I assume he... Yeah. I don't know.
Depends a lot on where he was headed. In
yeah.
And I don't know exactly where.
We will pass that along. Any other thoughts or comments? Ben, do you want to start?
Yeah. So what I just gave you was a couple of letters, the form that we use for the 10-year renewal, and the questionnaire that goes with it. So the top letter was his approval. That came last. So they're kind of in reverse order. So what we got was the form, if you go to the form page. And what was originally on it was that he used 50% of the lease and the note at the bottom. There was no 300 bushels on it. There was no 15 cages. I wrote those in after a phone call with the gentleman. So when I got this, he said he used 50% of the lease. He didn't have any mandatory reporting. His was zero. He didn't really have any other conflicts with the questions. It was about a 15% of the lease had some SAV in it, but that wouldn't be enough to deny renewing it. So we sent him the second letter that's in the package, the longer letter, and basically said, you know, we're not going to renew the lease. Please get in touch with us to give us more information. So he did, because he was panicked that I was taking his lease, and called me numerous times, and we played phone tag for a couple days. But anyway, when I talked to Mr. Mall, he immediately said, well, you know, he started to go down this long speech about his lease, and I said, look, let me ask you a couple questions. This is the reason you got the letter, OK? okay? You said you use 50% of the lease. I said, people tell me they use 25% of the lease, and I still approve it depending on what they did. You said you planted Shell, but I need some number. I know you may not have a record. Do you have some recollection of what you've done? And we had a pretty robust 10 or 15 minute conversation about different times he had put Orchard Shell on the lease. He also mentioned in his note that he had cages, but he didn't tell me how many. He didn't say what he was doing with them. You know, he obviously didn't have any harvest. At least he hadn't reported any commercially. So during a conversation, we ascertained he had 15 cages that he was growing oysters in. He had not harvested any for commercial sale, and that he had planted 300 bushels of shell or culture material over the 10-year period. So doing that math, it's an 18-acre lease. You know, he may not quite meet the threshold with 300 bushels, but he's got 15 cages of oysters. And I told him, I said, based on what you've told me, I'm putting some notes on your form and initialing them per our phone call, I'm going to renew your lease. And I renewed it that same day and printed the second letter. So that's an example of one that initially when I got it, I could not in good faith say it met the criteria. Even though I knew there was some underlying notes there that might indicate he's actually may have done enough, but he didn't give me enough detail. So this was one of the gray ones. This wasn't one where they put 0% and they didn't put anything on the form. They didn't write anything in the note. You know, those, I don't even know what to ask them because we gave them a form. We think the questions are fairly clear to say something. But this one was, and I get a number of these, and I've gotten them in the past, and I'm definitely going to get them in the future when we're looking at these a little more critically. So that's just kind of the way this one transpired as an example. If you have any questions about what you see on there and how I did it, I'll be happy to try to address them.
So did you, the back form for
yes.
The last question, it says lease renewal recommendation. Did you check yes or did he check yes? No.
They don't get, this is our internal form.
Okay.
They don't. They just get the questionnaire. I pull up the lease. First thing I do is look at mandatory reporting. I go down to that next to the last question, and I put yes or no. And then I put what the form put. And that's ones where sometimes they say they did a lot, mandatory reporting said they didn't, or the opposite. They didn't put down much for mandatory. And if it's to their disadvantage that they didn't report properly, in other words, they're saying they did a lot, but mandatory, I refer those to mandatory reporting for them to follow up. And I kind of put them on hold before I approve them because, you know, if he really harvests what he said on the form, we should have a mandatory report for that. So he needs to get that straight with them. Then I just start going down the questions. I bring up the map. I look at the lease. The SAV layer is turned on for the last 5 years. I look to see how much of the lease has SAV in it. I put the percentage down, approximate. Yes or no, it has it. Maybe a comment. If it has 90% SAV, all right, I'm going to have to look at this kind of hard, you know, whether we want to renew it. Look to see if there's any channels. Look to see if there's any piers. And that's a yes or no. If it's piers, I'll say, yeah, three piers encroach slightly in the lease. You know, not a big deal. Eight piers encroach completely across the lease. And now we're getting into, is this really conflicting with using it? Is it adjacent to other properties? This is land. Does it butt right up to the land? And that's a yes or no question. Water quality, wetlands, other reasonable uses, they're usually no, because I don't see anything that looks like that would be a problem. Impact to other resources, usually that's no. We added this past compliance question. Have we had some compliance issues with this person in the past? That's almost always no, but not always. And then the last two. If I'm not going to renew it, I'll check no, and I'll put some comments on this sheet. For posterity, so if somebody can come behind me and say, well, this is some of the reasons why he said he denied it. If it's a yes, it's a yes. I sign the form that he filled out at the bottom. I go in the database, I click approved. If I'm denying it, I go in the database and click denied, and they get a letter saying your lease has been terminated. So that is one example of really recent one that we got. And that lends itself to the fee increase. I mean, this took quite a bit of time for me to evaluate this one, and the phone call, and the letters back and forth. So a lot of them are easy. This one was not one of the easier ones. But it was fairly easily resolved.
Just out of curiosity, did he tell you when he used his cages?
When?
Because curiously, he's been shelling the bottom. He says he's had cages down, and he's had no reported production.
I'm trying to remember the phone call. I don't think I specifically asked him that, but I got the impression that the cages were relatively recently placed. And there was limited places he could put them on the lease. He talked about the channel, it's too deep, and we talked a lot about that on the phone. He said, you know, big portions of this lease, he says, I can't really use. It's sort of in the travel, it's not a marked channel, but it's the deeper area. It's too deep for him to put cages. I think it's probably too deep for him to put shell and figure he can work it. So, and some of it's sands. It's in a area where there's some sand movement, too. So, you know, and I consider all those things, too, when I'm talking to the person, related to the percent they said they used and how they're using it. So we understand there's lots of leases where there's 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50% of lease is really not suitable. It's not suitable for shelling, it's too soft, not suitable for cages, it's too deep, it's too much fetch, you know. So it is a multifaceted approach to this, and that's why you see in the guidance document so many potential things we could look at to consider.
You got no response from him until you sent him the denial letter, right?
Right. Well, he sent the form in
right.
with just the 50% in the note. And then I sent the first letter that said, you're being denied.
September 9th.
Right. But I, but in that letter, I did...
Telephone tag.
Right. Okay. I customed his letter just slightly, just a standard letter that goes out when I deny one for not meeting the criteria. And this one, I kind of had an idea that we could work on this one, and I kind of knew what I needed. I needed numbers on this
right.
one. So I kind of customed a couple sentences in this letter. I changed it slightly to the standard letter. Most people just get the letter saying you didn't meet the criteria. They still call, a lot of them, want to know why. But this one I kind of knew we were going to have a phone call.
When you have a conversation with somebody like that, and he's clearly outlined significant sections of the lease that are not usable to him,
right.
What are the impediments or the issues related to opening that issue back up, redrawing the lease, particularly if it's at a lesser area? Does it have to go back out for advertisement, or can the boundaries of a lease that have been awarded be mutually agreed upon, adjusted inward?
The quick answer is yes. The code clearly states that a person can ask to have their lease reduced in size at any time. There's no public interest review of that. We're shrinking it, we're making it smaller, per their request. The bigger hurdle would be whether the current law gives us the right to say, we're going to renew 50% of your lease based on what you put on the form. And maybe a phone call saying, I can't use this part. And we'd say, well, why do you want to keep it? You know, we're getting $1.50 an acre. If we lose half the lease, not a big revenue loss for the state. And maybe it frees up conflicting use, beneficial use for some other use that would be better. I'm not sure we're at that point. The law may allow us to do that. We're trying to glide in gracefully on this law and not put the hammer down.
It was mutually acceptable.
But certainly. And I think Hank had one already. He discussed it today. Before we met in here, we had a little quick meeting, that he had a leaseholder who realized when his 10 years was up, he probably couldn't meet this threshold. He voluntarily said, I want to lop off a section of my lease. We were lucky. We could go from existing corner. All we had to do is draw a new plat. We didn't have to go out and stake it, technically, because there was no new corners. So for $100, that's all we charge for a new plat. You could shrink your lease.
And once it shrunk, that piece that he gave up is now available for public leasing.
Right. Someone could apply for it, but we go through the public interest. You know, what are you going to use it for? This guy said it's not good for us to ground. You got some unique way you're going to use it that it's going to work? And maybe they do. Maybe they don't. But yeah, that option's always there. And we've had people do that rarely, but occasionally they had large leases and decided even at $1.50 that they didn't want to pay, you know, $300 a year. They wanted to pay $150, so they shrunk the lease in half. So.
I think I mentioned this before, but I'll bring it up again. When we send in our checks on our yearly rent, the little snippet at the bottom says, are you using the ground, yes or no? So maybe you could just expand that a little bit to say, if you're not mandatory reporting, are you using this ground or not? And then let them explain there and then capture that data so in 10 years you have more to go on. Because again, finding records for the past 10 years, it's hard. It's hard whether you're a small grower or a huge grower. So you can capture that daily, that data on a yearly basis. If you're not mandatory reporting, then I think it would streamline. Obviously, it won't help you for the next 10 years, but I think it would go a long way.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. We'll take that under advisement. I think I explained this once before. In the old database system, before we went from Access to the current type of database, we did capture that. Every year, that actually got entered when the rent was entered, whatever you, it was yes or no, and there was a field we could actually write in what you wrote. The way it got captured in Access was not, you couldn't reproduce it back out. It would overwrite the previous year, would overlap some of the text from the previous year. So it was all kind of screwed up after a few years. We couldn't use it. But certainly with the types of databases we have now and the guy we have that does it, he could add a thing where we could still enter that data. And we wouldn't have to go back and pull out the rent statements and look at them. We'd have it in the database, pull up the lease, what did they say each year? Yes, no, what did they include? So we could do that.
And if it hits the mandatory reporting, then you have that captured. It's just when they don't mandatory report, it's the same place.
I'll pass
for now. We've already sent out the rent statements for this year, right? Like that's all been done?
Yes.
Okay. So something we can definitely look into, that'll take a little bit longer to implement just because we won't have a chance until next go round because we do rent all in one go, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. But yes, that's a good idea. Yes, Beverly.
The information that Tommy sent was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had made notes. I went back and looked at some of the notes from suggestions made a couple meetings ago on the graph. So I wanted to mention that I think that where it says bushels of seed planted on the form, the application for reassignment of moisture planting should be changed to seed planted, not bushels of, just seed planted and then how many. Because he brought up a good point that if you're using, you know, nursery grown seed, it's not going to be bushels, it's going to be quantity.
Basketball size.
Well, yeah, depending on how many millimeters you buy your seed. You buy them. Some people are lucky enough to buy half inch seed, and other people don't have the money to do that. They have to buy them little and work them longer.
Okay.
So just, you know, seed planted, how many would be make more sense,
okay.
I think. And then also, I thought we had said something about, and I wrote it down on the draft. Other factors that the commission should consider. Modify that instead of at the top of page. Next to the last page of the new draft, a set of additional factors that can be considered by the commission when considering whether we had talked about it, just saying other factors that may be considered. Not nitpicking, but you know, could include. There's other factors that are not listed here.
Well, if you go to the next page, it does, I don't know if this addresses it or not, but right above D,
right.
It does say the commission can consider other factors if deemed appropriate
right.
that aren't part of these.
Right.
So we realize there's unforeseen things that we may be a factor and we don't even know about them yet.
Right.
And the commission should certainly consider those. But I mean, we'll warn a woman to tweet that some if it's not clear, but.
And then help me, Ben. I don't remember how we decided to deal with this, but there was some lengthy discussion around rotational use, just like any other farm where we do, where you, and Tommy mentioned it too, where you
right.
move one place closer to where you let, you know, actually bring your harvest in the summertime, et cetera, you know, rotational use, so that.
Right. So the last bullet. The last bullet on the third page,
right.
operational plan, which may include the use of multiple leases for seed propagation, nursery rotation, buffers, and aquaculture enclosures.
Also, several bullets up, rotation with other leased areas.
So that would, you think that would cover that?
I think the two of those combined should cover, you know, rotation through leases and then using, you have a use plan that clearly states I'm using some for nursery, some for, I use a rotation plan, and that would be in your use plan too. And I agree. I think Tommy's document is excellent. I think on things like float aquaculture, where we have to permit that, the ISSC and the model ordinance basically says we're the authority, which would be us in this case, that's permitting it, is supposed to require an operational plan as part of the authorization. So I think what Tommy's done is great for his leasing. It certainly would work for float aquaculture as a good operational plan, which we might need separate from this whole leasing question we're talking about and guidelines, just for permitting purposes, to stay in compliance with the ISSC regulations. So.
If I can keep adding to what she's mentioning, I agree that I feel like GMPs need to be stated a little bit more clearly in here.
Sure.
I don't think that they necessarily need to be adjacent to each other. I think a lot of larger companies, or even smaller growers too, they have leases, but they're not necessarily touching, but they're still critical for the whole operation. And I don't think it's mentioned, and I think it needs to be mentioned that sometimes ground needs to, under BMPs, needs to rest and recover from farming, and that could take up to 2 to 4 years a lot of the times. So I just think that should be clarified in here. I think that we're assuming that anytime you take up a lease that it's under a consistent production, that every time you put something out there you're going to receive something. Again, I don't support the metrics, and I think we need to understand that not every year you get the same amount out of a lease. Sometimes you can go 10 years and have really poor production, and that turns into one of your best leases, you know, in the next 5 years. So I think we need to be cognizant that just because, you know, some years we have great years, a lot of the years that we don't. You mentioned diseases of MSX and dermo. I think we need to realize that we could be hit with any kind of emerging disease at any point. We might not be able to prove it. We might not have the data to say, oh, that is a disease. It might be so new, we might not be aware of it. So I don't think you can just limit it to MSX and dermo. I think we have to realize that a mortality event could be a new disease, an old disease, a disease from another state, or it just could be a mortality event. We had a triploid mortality on the west side of the eastern shore that wasn't documented for at least a year, but VIMS didn't really hear about it, and then it was almost too late. And a lot of the growers, they might, who have lost, had mortality, might have not even noted it on their reporting. So I think that we have to look at that a little bit. I think weather events, if we just hit a hurricane, that can rock our worlds. And we were lucky this time, but it could rock our world for more than just the 1 year class. You know, that could affect us across the board for many years of production. I think dynamics of location needs to be recognized. And again, I think I've said this before and I apologize. I feel like we're supposed to be strengthening and streamlining this process, whether it's for VMRC or for industry. I think that it should back up, and on the number, on the first step when we consider renewal, it should be if an entity is renewing and they're mandatory reporting anywhere on any leases, then that should cover them for a lease that they have not reported on. I think all industry agrees that if you're an entity, if you're working in this industry and you're mandatory reporting, that should give you guys enough to say this should be renewed. What I don't see on here is on the denial, I think homeowners that are holding ground that haven't reported or can't have it, or just holding it to deny access, or somebody that took up ground that's denying access to another grower, or prospectors that are taking up ground and they haven't used it in the past 10 years, I think that should be noted that it shouldn't be removed.
So I think a couple of notes on that. The requirement for documentation around MSX or DERMO was specifically to tighten up a loophole that's in the code. So the reason we specifically call that out is because that's already in the code, and we're trying to just tighten that up. So, and a lot of the things you talked about, you know, weather events, other mortalities, I think the catch-all for a lot of that is the phrase, you know, or other factors that the commission and staff deem to be sufficient. So I think, like Ben has shown, and you know, future staff will show, you know, I think we're going to largely try to assume good intent. That's where we're coming from. And in terms of being completely transparent, you know, we have talked as a staff here, and I've talked to the commissioner, and when we release the guideline, there's going to be a numerical value in there that's going to give staff a place to start. That is something that we feel like it's important for staff to have a place to start. We feel that there are a sufficient number of additional criteria. We have mandatory reporting. We have a lot of those things. But it's highly likely that when the guidelines are released, and the committee will see them again. We're not going to just take them to the commission without showing the committee the final draft we take to the commission. We're not going to do that. It'll come before you guys again. But in conversations with the commissioner and with staff, we feel that it's important as we implement the law that we have a numerical value as a place to start. So that is a note on that. But that is very helpful sort of additional information in thinking about other diseases and planning for the future and how we can make this as adaptive as possible. So what language can we include around new diseases? And as been shown, I think one of the valuable things of going to the case study is a lot of this is information from the growers, information from people. And we're trying to walk that line, which we'll get into with the use plans and the beginning of this. We don't want to burden people. We have heard that message of not trying to require a ton of information. But the more information you give us, the better it is and the more helpful it is. I think it might
be good to mention just along those same lines that when you have a conditional lease from Bureau of Shellfish Sanitation, and I keep track every year of how many days were closed due to the 1-inch rain, and some years over 100 days. Mm-hmm. So when you have those records, where it says water quality, I think it's the second bullet from the end, that's just another example of where I think the report, the numbers should reflect all the leases, or should be allowed to count for, because we move immediately to another lease for harvest when that lease is closed 100 days. So that affects how many bushels you take off one lease, but it jumps the other lease up. I think that's right that it shouldn't be 10 bushels per acre specifically for each lease without regard to how the business works.
hear that. And again, like, it's a starting point, much like mandatory reporting is for staff. Like, it's a starting point for us to say, if you meet this, you're good. Because we get a lot of, Ben, his team, gets a lot of renewals, you know, needs a place to start. But the whole goal is to be able to provide that so we can kick those, renew those easier, and then spend time on the bigger questions of, did this person have, you know, 125 days of closures? Have they made an effort? Have they done that? This is just to give us a place to start. Russ.
Got a few comments. First one is the second page of your guidelines under C. Look at the third paragraph under C. First line, you say significant production and reasonable planning. It's a statute. I read more as an or there, so I would suggest you change the and to an or, or at least an and or.
I think that's directly from code, isn't it?
It's in the code, yeah.
That's directly from the...
Where I looked in the code, it appears it's an or. That's got a list of
we'll
three
fix
or four
okay.
things.
If it's an or.
Oh, okay.
It's the last one. It's got commas.
Oh, there's an and.
Between them, the last one says or.
Okay,
so
we'll
I take that they're all ors.
Okay,
so
I'll take a look at
that.
The
other thing, I don't have any oyster lease or production myself, but I shared this draft with three people that have, they're smaller producers, they do produce. They are riparian landowners too, not necessarily right fronting where their lease is. I shared with this to get some, I got some of their comments back from that. So I'm trying to represent, you know, the concern of the smaller producer here with it. First thing is, I understand from some it's sometimes hard to get shell. If you're not a big producer, that it's okay, you can get shell sometimes, but sometimes the MRC wants all the shell for restoration purposes or whatever, and that the bigger producers need to keep the shell used, what they are allowed to keep, they keep. And these people are kind of like small farmers, are kind of dependent on some of the bigger ones to, for like a farmer with, not all have combines if they're small farmers. They're kind of at the end of the line when it comes to getting, resources they need to operate. So some made that point. The other thing was about the one bushel per acre, and as I understand it, they asked a couple times that was based on wild harvest, reported wild harvest divided by the total baler grounds. And I checked the math, I got interested, and I checked a couple of years, and it looked like it worked okay, at least in 2 years I checked that. Looked like it was a little over that level. And I guess a lot of those open grounds are dredged. So the comment one of them had was if they hand harvest bottom, they may not be getting complete harvest like you would if you got some shallow lease there and you're hand harvesting without cages. They may not be getting 100%. I may not want them to get 100% because I'm interested in the long-term future of the Chesapeake Bay. So I think the intensity of the production, each one of these people thought you ought to have to do something reasonable to keep the lease. They agreed with that, in principle. So I think they had some concern with the one bushel an acre being applied in all cases, as a hard and fast, rule sort of thing. So I think just considering the intensity of production and the fact that you're supposed to give some consideration of the benefits and the impacts of it, there's probably, if you have any SAV, much rather see somebody walk in once every couple of years and harvesting the bottom where there's SAV than any bottom cages or any other kind of more intensive production, because it's going to be a whole lot less impact on the resource. And as far as the benefits, if they don't harvest 100% of them, I think if they're reproductive oysters, I think that's great. This, there may help repopulate some other areas you know, both on that bottom and off that bottom elsewhere. So I guess I heard the concerns Ann said about the metrics, and I'm kind of coming around maybe to thinking we need to be, maybe it shouldn't be exactly hard and fast on that. If it's conceptually a bushel of effort, maybe that's one thing, but if it's a hard and fast rule in all cases, I'm looking at Mr. Maul, but I know where his lease is, I guess, from the description. And, 300 bushels of shells, that's a heck of a lot of shell to have to come up with to put on 18 acres of lease. And I realize over a 10-year period, but you start thinking about the practicality of coming up with all the shell. Of course, his looks like he meets it for two or three reasons, so I guess they could have all been considered in together. But I would I would think you ought to consider hand harvest, and maybe that's some of what you call the recreational leases somewhat back in this the last section on the upper part of the last page here. But I do think it's important people are using it, and there is some reasonable production. They all stated that. So I would just offer those comments. And then the last one, I see the float aquaculture is still in there on the list of additional factors. And I understand that it was more not trying to single out float aquaculture as something that the MRC wanted to promote necessarily. Is more seemed like it's more the tracking system that you have, that the permittee may not actually have the lease. They may be working with some other leaseholder, but I would ask that you work out that tracking, and you can account. I'm okay, you're fine with accounting for the float production over the lease that it exists on, accounting that. But I think you're singling out a production practice that has a lot of opposition and a lot of other impacts to it, and you don't have other things listed. I mean, you don't list dredging, you don't list cages, hand harvest, that sort of thing. So I'd ask that the float bullet be taken out. Make that request again, as I did last time. Thank you.
So that's helpful. So a couple of points I want to stress is that when we look at this, we are bound by code. We are required to implement the code and implement the changes to the law. And the code tells us that the line we're trying to walk is requires significant production and reasonable planting of shellfish or gulch. Like, that's where we're coming at. That's what the code requires us to do. And so we're trying to get at what is an initial baseline of what we can look at and say, okay, you guys met this. If you didn't, this is not an automatic rejection. It is not if you did not meet this, then we immediately kick you out and we're done. It is okay, then we go on to the next step. Then we're going to cheer you off of this and figure out where this goes. So Ben and I have both said that several times. We will continue to say that. But that is the directive that we have to implement the code and figure out how we can pass this on to a new generation of staff. And that's why we are pushing fairly hard to give us some place to start. Otherwise, every case that comes in becomes subjective, and that's not what we want. And we don't think that is sort of good for the long term, right? We want to balance the use of this and make sure that the ground is to the highest and best use. That's our dog in the hunt on this. And that's what we have to implement, is making sure this ground is being used to its highest and best use. And so that's really where we're focused. In terms of the slope thing, hear your concern that you feel like we're calling out a specific part of aquaculture. Cages and dredges and stuff are assumed in all of this in terms of how you report and all of that. The float is specifically because you can have a float operation doesn't account for on the bottom. So hear your concern. We don't really see it as calling out or acknowledging. Calling out, I think, is a lot different from incentivizing. And I think it's just acknowledging that this is a different form of harvest. We have to account for it differently. But I don't think just having it in here is necessarily incentivizing, which I think is your concern. Ben, did you have thoughts? Also, before I kick it over to Ben, we have Pat Gear here today. So I think, as I mentioned at the last meeting, Rob O'Reilly retired after 32 years of service to the Commonwealth. And it's been definitely a loss for the agency. Luckily, we have Pat, who is now our new division chief of fisheries. And so he is now a new member of this. So I don't know how many of you know Pat, but yeah, so this is his stuff. So wanted to acknowledge him before I forgot. Finn. And I think Ann.
Yeah, to elaborate a little bit on what Helen said, the reason a floats is in there is floats are a permit. Floats have nothing to do with a lease. Dredging, hand tonguing, moisture by hand, those are all rights you have when you have a lease. That's how you work it. You don't need an extra permit. I mean, you need a license. But to get a float permit, you need a sole separate permit. Usually, it's the leaseholder. Not always. We do have a few float permits over someone else's lease. They have to have their permission. And how that gets reported, I agree with that. That's an issue. Are they reporting those oysters on that lease, or are they reporting them some other way? And that's an internal thing that we have to resolve. But if it's the leaseholder, I would report them as oysters I'm taking from my leased area, even though they're in the water column. And I think we will give you some credit for that, and I think we should. So that's why that's there.
Staff, entertain a compromise to try to address that instead of listing float first, put other, permitting activities that are, may not, this isn't the right wording, but may not, otherwise be attributable to the lease, but maybe apply the lease production, such as floats, put it as a such as.
We can look into that.
I think we can look at that.
I think if you turn it around, it'll be a little better. At least, because the real issue I'm hearing, if it's permitted and it's something that's not directly attributable to the lease, like the case you mentioned with somebody else has the lease, that they're working cooperatively with whoever's got the floats. The real issue is you want the permit production to be able to apply to the lease. Meet the criteria of the bushel and acre or whatever is used.
And the second bullet is, it actually does not say or in the code. It says significant production. I've worded it in here positively. It's worded negatively in the code. So it's talking about when we won't renew a lease. What it actually says is that the commission shall not renew or extend an assignment where there's been no significant production of oysters or clams, comma, no reasonable plantings of oysters, clams, or culch, or no significant aquaculture, which is what I have in the sentence. I have and instead of a comma because I wrote positive.
From a legal perspective, I think.
I think it's both. You've got to have
it
both.
It means an or. If it's an or at the end of the phrase with a, I think that's an or. But I'm not an attorney.
We can look into it. I think we'll have to go with what the code says. Thank you.
Hi, I'm an attorney. But I mean, I read it the way Russ reads it. Okay. I read it that way originally. So, but I'm not your attorney. So
we'll talk.
I would just say talk to your attorney because I think reasonable minds can maybe differ on this. But I my first impression on it was that it was you have to have one of these three things, not all three.
We'll definitely, that's a good point. We'll circle with our attorney at the AG to get some clarification, and we can clarify that before the next meeting. We'll do that. And if you have additional comments, and then Mark?
So if that's if it's one of the three things, then I think it needs to be clarified on your renewal, whether it's on the what we get, what you fill out, and on, again, back to the yearly, because I think if the code says one of three, significant production, reasonable planning, or significant aquaculture operations, if you had that explain additional effort for no significant production or no reasonable plantings or no significant aquaculture operations, I think somebody might catch that. I think you could captured under the significant aquaculture operation where somebody said, oh, I'm not producing on this, but I use this as our seed area or our broodstock area or our where we land the boat to, which is next to our planting. So I think if it was added in instead of just the reason for no production, I think that would help capture a little bit more data, whether it's on your 10-year renewal or on your year renewal.
other questions or comments on the on this before we move on to?
Just one very small comment back to the. I'm going to fully try to wordsmith things here, but the bullet that, that Russ was talking about with float or other permitted aquaculture activity, that other aquaculture activity discussion sort of moved into dredging, tongue harvesting. That's not what came to mind for me at all. I might call that an allowable activity or harvesting. Other permitted activity or activity use is sort of just contrasting other gear. I mean, if you really wanted to be more specific about gear, you're more likely to see in the water column floats or suspended gear. There's common enough to you, and you certainly had a permit that was denied that was suspended rather than floating gear at all. So that's just a bit of wordsmithing when you're thinking about doing that. And maybe it's not activity as much as gear that helps you out there in terms of.
Okay. Anything else? All right. I want to move on to the beginning. So I think we had asked you all to get some thoughts on what are some of the things and questions we should ask when we are looking to lease the grounds. This is the beginning of the process when we get permit applications. We talked about use plans, sort of what would be required in those, what we'd want to see from them. To remind people, some of, because there are some people that are not here, some of the concerns that we've heard are, you know, if we submit this use plan, is this the be all end all, and are we held to this in 10 years? And I think the answer is likely no. What we want to see from you, what the commission wants to see from you, broader you, sort of applicants, is if we are going to let this person use the bottom of the Commonwealth for 10 years, we would like for them to have put some thought into it and to figure out how are they going to use this ground. And so that's really what we're looking at. So we understand that there's a lot that happens in 10 years. Hurricanes, new diseases, you know, a lot of other things can happen. This is just to give us a sense of where is this person starting, sort of what's their experience, sort of what thought did they have given there. Sort of that's the framing and sort of the pre-response, some of the questions we're likely to get. But we would love to hear from you all if you have thoughts about what are some of the questions and concerns we can ask at the beginning of the process just to make it easier and to reduce user conflicts.
I think an obvious one is if somebody's leasing several, especially if it's several acres or so from you, and their intent is to shell the ground, traditional shelling. It's how you judge it afterwards, but it seems really worthwhile to ask the question: do you have an identified source of shell? It might not, but then that might be, then you have to decide where to go from the discussion. And you sort of know the answer to that if it's J.C. Walker applying for new ground, that they have an identified source of shell, but there's been a lot of people getting leases in the last half a dozen years that said repeatedly in front of the commission they intend to shell the bottom and don't stand a chance of doing it. There's not a source of shell than the shell 5 acres of bottom they get their hands on.
Okay. What else?
But I think that I'm just, you know, thinking back 10 years ago when we were encouraged to look at a different fishery than crabbing at that time because of the crab situation. We won't go into that, but Dr. Wesson provided support, not only instructional support, but ideas for the fact, or trying to, at least for me, letting me know. I mean, I was a crabber, so I didn't know anything about baby oysters or seed or bags or cages or anything, and he really provided me with some guidance about, now, when you know you're not going to have any oysters now for 2 years, you know, the first 2 years. You know, somebody starting out, we're talking about now, applying for a permit, they're not going to have any reported, I wouldn't think, reported harvest unless they get a lease that already has market-ready oysters on it. If they're actually going to do aquaculture, they may not have any oysters for 2 years to start with. And then we were encouraged to, wherever we took our oysters, to ask them if we could pick up the shell. When we delivered the oysters, can we have the shell and find a place where we cure the shell and all this kind of... In other words, it's not something that you go into without mentoring. And that would be, I'm assuming, that the same sort of thing would be provided by VMRC when somebody was applying for a lease. You would be nurturing them, and that's the purpose of VMRC, is to encourage the propagation. Therefore, say, okay, you know, you're applying for this lease. We're going to connect you with somebody in the agency that's going to help you understand what you're asking to do. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We started to do it. Dr. Wesson, I mean, I don't know if I should say a few more words, but he encouraged us before we ever had a lease. And we were allowed to use someone else's lease to put our seed on to start out, you know, when we started to do this. Until we could find a place to apply for a lease, which we did do through the help of VMRC. So I think what I'm trying to say is that most people who are starting out to do this, unless they've got a mentor, are going to look to VMRC to provide them with some ideas about what, and then they decide, well, I can't do that. You know, am I crazy? Y'all are looking at me like I'm crazy.
No, I think I you know, the history going back and Jim did a lot in sort of facilitating interest in aquaculture, primarily from folks who were in the water community, and it had a big impact. There's probably more places now that they could get that information, but I agree with you that if you've never done it, you need some mentoring. I think that the case I'm thinking about, the situation, I don't know how large it is, but if Jim were here, he would tell you it was quite large. Are those individuals, at least at the bottom, maybe are well-intended and think they're going to put shell on it, but really mostly they're going to dredge it. There's enough oysters on there that they can make a little. That's not the working industry. But Jim would tell you, and Andrew may have other more recent data, that a significant portion, of lease applications in recent years have been, as we've seen some oysters go up, not enough oysters on unassigned ground to make a living tonguing them. If you can drag a dredge across it, you can make a day's work out of it. And I think that's one of the things in a use plan, not the only thing that I think VMRC wants to try to tease out. I mean, you certainly had several of those in the last 4 or 5 years, quite a few of them that haven't been planted in shells, but have been dredged.
Well, I think that there are still, that was a crab disaster program that was sort of specifically people that you were speaking to who were affected by that crab disaster and signed up in that spat on shell program. And then we've had some outreach since then through NRCS for continuation of that. And I think Mark is correct. There probably are a number of leases out there that, you know, may have only be productive if you can't dredge them. But I think that, that, you know, staff here at VMRC is always willing to work with any leaseholder who calls or any person in the industry and try to point them in the right direction there. But I think that we do continue that outreach whenever possible. But I think in terms of staff time, I don't know if there's every lease application gets sort of that personal touch there that we try to do. And I mean, probably have time for 20 to 30 people a year, but I don't know about 300.
But are most of the people who are applying for leases now, Ben, are they planning to dredge?
I'd say at least 50%.
And just on production, what we get off private ground a day, only about, in 2018, 24 to 25% of private ground production is containerized aquaculture. So the other 75% of production off private ground is being caught with traditional gear, which is mainly dredges and scrapes.
But much of that is still gets shelled, has been shelled historically. Sometimes people are moving seed. It's not to imply that most of that is skirting the intent of the law. It's a portion of it, however, whether well-intended or not, proposes to put down shell, tells the commission they're going to put down shell, don't, and dredge it.
And this is sort of back of the envelope, but roughly 60,000 bushels of wild seed is transported to private ground every year, so that goes into that production. And then another 20 to 30,000 of additional private ground or public ground seed is transported to private ground again. So you sort of multiply that on top, and you're probably looking at, you know, less 50,000 bushels back of the envelope that's just coming off ground that hasn't had some sort of seed or transport or shell planted on. I would hold fast to those numbers, but that's sort of rough calculation based on gear type. So of the 300,000 or so bushels of harvest coming off private ground a year, that might be sort of ballpark where that's coming from.
Well, if people make an application, right, and you want them to do a business plan or something like that, would you be working in concert to look at that to see if that's even feasible?
That's a complicated answer. First, I would say that, before I answer that, that the vast majority of private ground now is not being shelled at all. It's being worked. And it's, if you work it correctly, it's sustainable. You can work ground, take the big horseshoes, leave the little ones, put the cull shell back as you're culling. There's not a lot of big operation of planting shell in the state anywhere anymore. Shell is hard to get, and it's expensive. Having said that, when a new person comes in, we do ask them what they plan to do, and some say, I'm going to shell the ground. Just keep in mind that I beat my head against the wall on this for the last 5 years. We've taken applications to the commission and explicitly said, there is no way this person can economically shell this ground. We've checked the ground. It's barren. And the commission has given them the lease, saying to staff, we can't tell a person how to spend their own money. That's a tough battle for us. And I think we have more tools with some of the changes in the law to keep iterating that point to the commission. But we need the commission's help to deny some leases that it's inappropriate to lease this thinking it's going to be shelled, because it's almost certainly not going to be. And that's the issue that we're up against. But I agree with Andrew. I mean, we try to adhere to everybody when it comes. We try to give them the best information we can. You know, I will tell people sometimes, are you really sure you want 100 acres and you're going to put that? How many cages? Have you bought the cages yet? No. You try to steer them into, well, you kind of need a business plan. You need to think this through a little bit better, because it's not in the state's interest to lease 100 acres to somebody who's going to fail, because we've got potential for abandoned gear, lack of orchards being produced, you know, so it's, but we can't, unfortunately, give quite the care that Jim was giving in that one-time program, because that money was geared specifically to move people into this industry. But we do the best we can with what we have to look what people are asking for and steer them in a reasonable direction.
And our hope is that with guidelines that come from this, that it'll be a little bit easier to staff to make the recommendation to the commission of, it's both an economic issue of this, it's unlikely this person can economically afford to shell, but also shell is a finite resource, and as stewards of this resource, we don't think that's a beneficial use of it. And so sort of changing a little bit of tax in terms of how we argue this, but also just having guidelines the commission can look and say, oh, this is one of the things we need to consider for all the myriad of uses. But we are going up against history. Mark.
I think the guidance document you've got here, appropriately most of the times it says shell, also says or culch. But of course you don't identify, nobody knows at this point what alternative culch they could get permitted. You could obviously get probably any other shell permitted from a native species, although that's equally in short supply. You get a fair amount of surf clam shells, but they don't hold up as well. At some point, and I mean as part of this, I mean, I think you're right to have culch there, but that becomes an individual lies other issue to tackle. There's other calls that's not as rare, but it's every bit as expensive.
Right.
More granite.
And they use other cults material a lot more than in Virginia, and a lot of Louisiana uses a lot of ground up concrete and other types of, and it works. It's not free either.
I think that would require a separate VMRC permit, anything other than shell. I think it's my understanding that
it always has in your hands.
What else? You would apply for after you had lease, correct? I mean, there'd be no reason to apply for that separate permit for that if you didn't have lease.
Well, I guess
it's
a chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't get shell, another way to do it is with coast material. Maybe we want to see that you've also applied for a permit for coast material at the same time you apply for lease.
I think if that were to be something that we began to see an increase in, or, you know, worked with them and had conversations about, is there a way to where we can move towards that? And particularly if we're starting to see a sharp decrease in shell, how can we figure out how to make that permit a little bit easier? So that's something that we would need. It hasn't come up in a lot of conversations, but I think it's something we can and should look into. So we would work on the timing of that. But I do agree with what Ben's saying. It would probably be you got to apply for them at the same time. Sort of. You got to get one and get the other. Mike and then Russ. You disagree?
I disagree.
Without
a permit, it doesn't matter whether you're using shells, concrete, broken up toilets. Get your lease first,
okay,
and then you go through the permitting process. Because if you don't have a lease, it doesn't matter whether you have a mountain of shells or a little tiny bit of shells. I always advise people, get your lease first.
I agree. It's a bit of a separate issue, maybe on the side, broader issue, to start having a conversation about what types of alternative cults might be permissible. Work through that. Maybe it's not the top of this, but the work that this committee now has to do. There'd be some advantages to beginning to put some bounds on it. There was a time it was toilet seats. There were
broken up toilets.
And even before that, fire chips.
Yep.
Fire chips in the late in the late 80s. They put fire chips.
Did you just watch
that
idea? I'm probably a minority staff opinion here, but I'm not sure all cults material would need a permit. The code says cults. The code says cults already. If it's a non-benign natural element, like stone or ground up, maybe Tony's going to hit me in the back of the head in a second, but they didn't put cults in there for no reason.
So clearly something we need to look into.
I've been in code a long time.
What was cults considered to be in 1890
had to be stone.
Was it shell?
I think it was shell. I would argue it was shell.
Okay. We take culture out of the code then.
That history project aside, I saw Russ's hand went up. I didn't know. We'd love to get a few more thoughts as we go through this on, you know, what questions should we be asking? How can we do our due diligence at the beginning to make sure people are getting this? So Russ and then Ann.
Yeah, I'll tie it into that question, I guess, but it just dawned on me, you talk about the code, so I just looked at the code again. Code doesn't use, not in this passage anyway, elsewhere, it doesn't use harvest as a word that I, or maybe it's in there and I can't see it. I'm blind, but it talks about production of oysters or produce oysters, produce or plant. I suppose there's some conservation organizations that plant oysters in sanctuaries and probably don't want them harvested, and I thought VMRC had some oyster reefs before that they really didn't want people going in helping themselves do as well. So I would, you know, it just dawned on me, the code says production or produce. You can produce oysters and never harvest them. So, you know, just a aha moment, is production the same as harvest, or does production mean to grow?
I think that the addition of the statement about the public benefit covers the restoration and production people. That was, if you recall, one of the big discussion points during the Secretary's work group about the restoration efforts that never harvest anything, but they're on least part.
I think that's why I thought that was an or instead of an and previously.
And we've had conversations, we've had a lot of conversations internally about that, both around the working group and then around many things like Army Corps projects and how we ensure that they have longevity. And that's a whole other, I'm not kicking open that door for this conversation, but I'm looking at Tony, and I think one of the things is that we're thinking and we're looking that some of those projects may not actually need to be on a lease. There's other permitting for them. And so there's other ways to get at reefs as part of the broader Chesapeake Bay restoration, which I imagine is what you're referring to, which, you know, we are committed to, the governor's committed to, so we want to make sure we have that process in a good place. But we are looking at ways to figure out how to balance that. But I think for most of the leases and stuff, we are looking at production in terms of harvest, but I'm looking at Ben right now. Mandatory reporting is harvest, you know, some of those things like that. But again, it also gets into the effort question.
I think to address specifically Russ's point, not sure what to do with number one, where it says consider harvest of one bushel to be a minimum for lease renewal, maybe turn that to production, but certainly in the second sentence where it says for a lease to be renewed, I think we could add non-commercial production to, in addition to planting, culture, and that would cover people who are, but now they produce the oysters, but they don't have any mandatory reporting. We do need to capture recreational, the people who aren't really in this commercially, but are propagating oysters on their lease and are harvesting some, primarily for personal use. So I'll work on tweaking that a little bit. I think this is a point well taken.
Personally, I don't like oysters, but I may want to grow them because I think they might propagate into other areas. And my son likes them, so he pulls that here. He blows that, but anyway.
That's just because you're eating the ones from the Rappahannock River that don't have enough salt in them. You need to go get some of those Eastern Shore ones.
Well, it wasn't a lot of salt last year, that's for sure.
Ann, you had your hand up.
At the work group, you had a potential use plan. I thought that I didn't get to see it in Richmond, but you had it floating around. Do you have a copy of that for us to start to take a look at?
Sure.
Yeah, we can circulate that.
It'd be nice to see before we dive into this a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think in Richmond, we also talked about one of the beginning things, I think that one of the biggest topics was if this goes through, then you're not already mandatory reporting, I know I keep saying that, I apologize, then there should be a follow-up at some period before 10 years is up to make sure that you're sticking to your plan or that you're actually doing what you said. Because your example of Mr. Mall or whoever you had, if he had a five-year checkup, then you figured out that, no, you either have too much ground or you're getting sanded or you're not doing something, and it would have probably streamlined this process a lot more midway than what he went through and the cost at 10 years.
So one of the things that, so on that note, one of the things that has come up as we are implementing the law, developing the various guidelines and regulations that we need is it has become pretty obvious that we're a little short-staffed to implement this program as it is, and we're taking steps to do that. We support the governor's budget, but we are looking at how to address that, because I think that it would, some of those things in terms of how can you contact people with mentors, unlikely to be able to replicate that program because that was disaster relief money, but some of these ideas are really good, particularly as we figure out how to grow this program and how to do that, and sort of where we can move to help the industry. So that's good. I think with current staff, we would be hard pressed to do some of that, because I think they're pretty flat out as it is, and our and we have a backlog as it is, but that is really good to think about as we try to grow the program. So that's very helpful. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, thank you.
So what about as you send the invoice for the rent, if that's on an annual basis, then ask them if they want to, just on a voluntary basis, to send in any records that they have from that year that could just get attached to their computer file so that they don't have to keep up with it, and then there's some, you know, history along the way.
I think that's something we can look into. We want to make sure that we can hold those records in a way that's not burdensome to us. I think we have a fairly large record keeping system as it is right now between shellfish habitat and fisheries, and so we just want to figure out how we can best do that and sort of figure out where the liability would be then. But it is an interesting thing to look at as we do it. And the good thing about the rent thing is, because we've cycled through for this year, that is an area where we can unpack and test, I think, as we move forward this year and be prepared to do that next summer. So that's, as we collect those ideas, that's really helpful.
I think with the annual, even just a reminder for themselves to keep their records, it's just sort of an annual reflection back on what they might have done. Because I know from my own job, I couldn't tell you what year I worked on one lease versus one, you know, whatever the projects are.
Right.
And it just is all going to run together. And so over a 10-year period, I do think it is very difficult. And anything that you can do to prompt them to maintain them in some way, but sending them in, at, you know, to the extent you have the data capacity to hold on to.
Yeah, and I think some of this is, as Ben often says, you know, right now we're also in that spot where we're basically retroactively applying the law as these lease renewals come up, particularly over the next 2 to 3 years, right? They're going to get caught sort of that this is the first go-round of this, and I'm hoping that the more, like, we get the guidelines out and we do the education, the more we push out, in 6-8 years, this won't be as much of a problem. I think it's really right now is the next 2 to 3 years is the big pinch point. And so how can we solve that moving forward? But, yeah, I think it's going to be a challenge. What else? We can speculate the, definitely speculate the use plan. And we can, I think other states also require use plans, so we can circulate those to give people a sense of what else we have. Let's see what other industry do. Mike.
You currently have a little survey questionnaire on your lease application. It's voluntary. What additional information do you think you really need other than those questions? In other words, can you make those questions your legally binding use plan?
Well, it's the only questionnaire we have at the moment, and we do use it. I wouldn't say it's exactly voluntary. We do say you have to answer the questions, yes or no. We won't continue to process your application. I think our thinking has been, since the task force and then this committee, is that enhancing that questionnaire is what we're trying to do, and still keep it as short and simple as possible. So I think the short answer is yes, I think we can adapt those questions to include some of these ideas even we've talked about today. We don't ask a lot right now. We just say, are you going to use traditional methods, which means shelling, planting seed, gulch, whether you need a permit or not, and cages. And cages more than 12 inches, and floats. And with the caveat statement right in there, if you're planning to do floats, this is not what you need, at least. You've got to have some other permits. Or some other thing we've never heard of before. We didn't give you a chance to say that. I think under the law as we see it now, that requires us to use 1205 of the code, beneficial impacts and detriments of aquaculture, and the public trust doctrine, some of which we were using before, does require us to ask a few more detail type questions. And I think to address the whole, is it appropriate to lease this ground, you know, we have to do a lot of internal work, but there are a few questions we can ask the leaseholder that will help us guide the commission on whether we think it's in the public interest to lease this ground for shellfish versus leaving it for some other use. So,
one of the concerns I have is that if someone asks for, say, a 10-acre lease, and they say they're going to put cages on it, do you want them to put down the absolute maximum number of cages that they anticipate? Or do you want them to say, okay, I've got this 10 acres, I'm going to start with 15 cages, knowing that if he's successful with 15 cages, they're probably going to go up to 20 cages and then 30 cages. And, you know, eventually on that 10-acre lease, they could have quite a few cages if they're successful. But if I'm starting out, I don't know how successful I'm going to be. And I'm not going to be able to tell you that I'm going to have 300 cages on this lease in 8 years.
Right.
I might only have 30 cages on that 10 acres simply because I'm having problems.
Right.
So when you ask for them cages or shell, sure, I'll check cages. I don't know how many.
Right.
So you could have some problems getting someone to give you a business plan that has detailed information in terms of how many cages they're ultimately going to have.
Right.
Thinking out loud of some problems that you're going to have with the form.
I agree. I think there's two approaches we could take. We could ask more specific questions like that. Say, if you check yes, provide a detailed plan, even if it's in phases, put that in, or you check yes as part of the process of staff just following up on each individual application. We will just talk with the applicant. Okay, you said yes, let's have a conversation about what your plan is, because we need this at the staff level to evaluate it. We may need it to take to the commission at some point if we can't make an administrative decision, and just get it informally. And it's a tough question of how much. I know industry wants this use plan to be simple and least questions possible, but we want enough information to be able to do our job. So the question is, how much do you ask up front and how much do you just do as part of the process? I don't have an answer for that. Hopefully y'all have some guidance.
That's why I raised the question.
Right.
That's a concern.
I would, as a riparian landowner, I would support more information, like especially traditional could mean several things, as you mentioned. But you know, if there's more categories, is it hand harvest? Is it you know, dredge, scrape, or what? What is that? You know, cages. I think you already have a checkbox for that one. But I'm just thinking, you have a lot of leases that are protested. And it could be, depending on the intensity of the production, the people protesting the leases may not protest them if there were certain types of production they thought were going to occur versus the worst case scenario with it. So I think that gets into, you know, type of production, but also intensity as far as how much impact and negative impact that's going to have on somebody trying to get access to their land, use their land, enjoy their land, basically. So I would support more information there. I don't know, you know, the rub. I hear what Mike's saying, that industry needs a little bit of flexibility because you don't know necessarily exactly what things may evolve to. But maybe you need some kind of management plan for the duration of the lease that spells out what, you know, what type of production it's going to be, and maybe there needs to be some mechanism if somebody wants to modify that plan at some point. I think we'd have to think about that, because you know, you could tell them you're going to do hand harvest, and then 3 years later come back and say, well, I want a bunch of, you know, I want 5,000 bottom cages out there, and the people that, you know, might have protested that didn't because they thought that was a situation. But have to think carefully about how that sort of thing would work and play out. But I would contend that there's a lot of people, you know, maybe objecting to these leases because of just the uncertainty. They don't know what it could be. Mm-hmm. And I would paint myself in that corner as well, that I would, certain types of production I'd be happy to support, very supportive of. There's other types, there's probably a place for it. It may not be right where I want to get to my property and that sort of thing. So, but there's probably a place for the other types of production. So I would encourage staff to, you know, have more information there as far as the type of production and probably some kind of management plan involved as well with the lease.
Mike?
We've already seen lease applications being protested that said that they were going to put shells on the bottom. And the people who protested said, well, they say they're going to do it, but they can change their mind in 3 years. And that's the fear of the unknown. And I don't know how your use plan is going to take care of that.
So that's the conundrum of the use plan. That's the use plan is
a modification
language. Unless you make a use plan mandatory. If you tell me this is what you're going to do in your use plan, then that's all you can do. Unless we do that, and I'm not even sure we can under the current code, you know, we got that conundrum. Because you're right. The vast majority of protested applications there are fear of cages. I can guarantee you that. I've done this a long time.
Worse.
We occasionally get a protest for a straight, going to use the bottom. Traditionally, I don't want a dredge boat outside my house at 7 o'clock in the morning. We do get that on occasion, but not very much. It's the fear of cages. And he's right. Look at applications where they absolutely say they will never put a cage on it and still gets protested because they could. And they could sublease it to someone who will, or they could transfer it to someone who will. And a transfer doesn't have any public interest review. So you don't get to protest a transfer. We handle that internally. So this is the conundrum of a use plan. We can put everything we want in it. More information is definitely better. So the public's more informed about what the person said they plan to do, how we're evaluating it, but there's still, here's the things you can do on the lease. You can dredge it, you can hand tong it, you can pick up, you can put cages on it with some restrictions. Those are all allowed once you get the lease. No matter what your use plan says you're going to do.
The top one is...
Hold on, I think there's a few other people. So Ann, and then Ben, and then Russ will come back.
Again, we enrichment, and I realized Russ wasn't enrichment. We covered this. So again, use plans, if it was me applying for a lease, I'm going to check all the boxes because I need that flexibility, whether it's my personal business being a small grower or for J.C. Walker Brothers, checking all the boxes because I need that flexibility. What I think Russ needs and what we didn't hit in Richmond is a public education initiative. There's a half a dozen states that are educating the public on what's going on with aquaculture to take Russ's fear out so that they understand what's going on. We didn't hit that in Richmond. We didn't hit funding to educate the public. So all this fear is gone on what we're doing. We talked about use plans for someone in the business and somebody new to the business. So I think with Russ's concerns and a few other people's concerns, if there's someone new in the business and they're saying they're going to put cages or they're going to put 100 cages and really it's either they're saying that they're going to put 5 cages on 100 acres or it's shelling the bottom and you know that there's not enough shell or it's not, then we need to figure out how to capture that. I'll agree that we need to figure out how to capture that. But for a use plan for someone who's mandatory reporting and who's doing this, then we're going to be checking all the boxes.
I just had a couple questions about this. The current application I have was revised on March the 4th of this year, 19.
Yes.
Is that the one you're using now? And the fact that I think that there are over 400 applications in the queue. Is that right, Ben?
A little under 400. We actually whacked them down some. We're down like 375.
375 in the queue. And some of them are 4 years old.
Yep.
You know, so I think that your point about staff, okay, and resources and all that kind of thing, we have to keep that in mind too, because we're talking about the people that have already applied and that are in the queue are not going to want to have to reapply. That would not be fair. I don't know what will happen there, but I think looking at the application that the committee looked at in Richmond, or the use plan mm-hmm. outline or something, and then talking about what's reasonable, not only for people who are applying, but for staff, because if it becomes such a onerous thing, you're going to have 800 in the queue.
And so the backlog is for a couple of reasons. One, we've had staff limitations, and you all know this, but I want to state it for the record. That is, our staff works tirelessly on this and are out about it. It's just a sheer volume issue.
Yeah.
And also the commission meeting. We can only bring so many protested cases to the commission meeting. So there are two bottlenecks. But I just wanted to go on record of that in terms of supporting staff.
You see that? I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
The workload, we can make ourselves into a situation where you can't even possibly plow through it.
Right.
Particularly for those who have been in the business
mm-hmm.
and are doing things right.
Right.
Russ, do you have some additional comments? I'm going to give you
I think with the bottom cages, it's not, you said it's fear of cages. I think personally with me, it's more I can support bottom cages personally, just speaking for me. But the intensity of those is what I probably would, you know, if you get too intensive with them, probably puts it over the edge. But I think it's not only whether there's cages or not, but it's the intensity of the type of operation that's out there. So, you know, if there's rows of cages 90 feet apart or something, I can run my boat to get to my land in between them, and it's not as big an issue as if you have wall-to-wall cages blocking you, and then, you know, other impacts as well. So I think it's, and I realize it makes it even more difficult to capture, but I'm just reacting, and I guarantee I need a lot of education, so I accept your comment with that, because I definitely need educating frequently. That's my thought with it. I think the more information you can get, the better. It might comfort some people to some degree, at least, although, you know, if it's true, you can really, you know, you can do anything you want in the 10 years. You know, that's probably a problem, and that's not going to result in comforting people very much. So, thank you.
Mike?
Just a little response to the production issue.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what Russ is saying. He doesn't want to get hemmed in. But at the same time, the commission has the authority to have people move cages mm-hmm. if they are impeding egress, mm-hmm. egress to their property.
Yep.
And that's always been made very clear in every hearing I've ever sat through,
yeah.
that the commission can have people move cages. If you can't get to your dock, all you have to do is tell them, and they will make it so.
I don't have a dock because I don't want to ruin the property from its natural state. Anyway,
you can't
I do
get
want
to your kayak
property.
Lodging for
yeah,
it.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. I always say move or remove.
Right.
There are times where we might tell a person,
yeah.
move or remove.
There's no place left on your lease you can put these. They need to be removed. They're causing a problem in this area. You just can't put cages in anymore. And we have that authority. The regulation's written that way. So, and it is reactive, not proactive. We advise people if they ask us. People submit a plan to me on where they want to put the cages. I will review it and give them my opinion based on mapping, their shape of their lease, bottom type, everything I can get my hands on. You know, I'd advise against putting cages in that spot in the way you're doing it. Maybe do this. We still might get a complaint, and we might address it after the fact, but there is no requirement in the regulation that you provide a plan up front. Once you get a lease, you can put cages on it. Follow the regulation. Don't put them in a way that's going to adversely impact navigation or cause some other problem. So it tends to be more reactive than proactive, but it could be proactive if people give us a plan in advance. New applications, I think, the more information, the better. You're right. If you want to do cages, tell us some general plan on what you think you're going to do. This is the shape of lease you're asking for. What do you think you're going to do with it?
That's a point that I made at the Secretary's work group, that there's a huge difference between a newbie applying for a lease and someone who's been in the business for decades. A person who's been in business for decades understands what they're getting and what they can and cannot do on that piece of ground. Those people should be given more leeway in what information that you need, because you know that if you get an application from Ballard's, they're going to use the ground properly. But if you get an application from Joe Blow, who's never been in the industry, this is his first lease, that person is someone that you should definitely question. Do you know what the hell you're doing? And most of the time, they don't.
Or as Beverly would say, mentor them.
Mentor them. And I think that's an important point. I think what I will also state is that we also want to make sure that this is an industry that can grow, and that we are not in any way dissuading new entrants. We are not putting our thumb on the scales or any way appearing that. And so, you know, everybody was new once, and the sort of the new generation is coming up under a different set of rules. But we do want to make sure that this industry can grow and that new people can come into it. So that is something we have to look at. Anne?
I don't think he's advocating to exclude anybody from. I think that what he's saying is that making sure that they're following through on what they're doing, so that we don't have a bunch of cages or something abandoned out there. And I think that BMRC and industry, especially, that it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I like to see, and I don't know if you can capture it, of the 400, I like to see of the applications that are out there right now, how many, do you have any idea of how many newbies are on there? I know that when I look at the Seaside application stuff, I'll see one guy and he has four applications. I know he doesn't have any experience. So do you have any, can you tally that or summarize that for the next meeting?
Not off the top of my head. I could probably go through the list, and having worked here as long as I have, come up with a little bit better estimate than just, I can't really tell you off the top of my head right
now. I've looked at the list repeatedly, and most of the people on the list are people whose names I recognize or companies I recognize. It's not the majority that are new. It's the majority that are not new. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would agree that the majority of people that we know have other leases. There's at least one other lease. But there is a sizable percent of new people all the time coming in. Enough to have an impact. Enough new people who don't necessarily know exactly what they're doing yet.
What else? So I think so the next steps for us is we will cull through our notes and figure out what are some of the follow-ons that we need to get back to you guys on the sort of the new entrants versus established people for the applications. I have a couple. There were some wordsmithing suggestions and some questions on the guidelines. We can circulate the use plan that we had previously circulated, and then some other getbacks. So the second Monday of October is Columbus Day. So MRC is closed. We are also realizing, as staff is preparing for budget season and general assembly session, that we're seeing increasing demand on workloads. So what I'm going to suggest is that we don't meet in October, and we meet in November. Second Monday in November is Veterans Day, so we will go back out to you guys with a different date, most likely the following Monday, although we may move it to that first Monday. We will do a doodle poll again with the last one. Majority is going to rule. It just makes it easier. But unless people are really clamoring for trying to find a reschedule in October, I think we would be better serve you all to come back in November And before the November meeting, what we will try to do, hopefully about a week in advance from whatever date we set, is to circulate the updated guidelines for what we have, so you can process it a little bit more before the meeting. So that's what we will get back to you on. And as always, in between now and then, you can reach out to all of us, any combination of us, if you have additional thoughts, comments, questions. If you think of something that you feel like would help our process, please don't feel like you've got to wait until the meetings. We'd love to get any feedback between now and then. That's helpful to us. Anything else? All right. As always, we are very appreciative of your time that you give us and your patience, and it is much appreciated. So, thank you.
Yeah. Right. No. I don't think so.
Yes. 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 Yes